Welcome to 45 North's first Sound Salon, a live conversation and performance inspired by America's sonic history. I'm Ann Strange Jamson, and we're listening to a piece of that history. This is a rare, one-of-a-kind recording of a Jewish dance orchestra. It's a living record of a time, a place, and a community that vanished after the Holocaust. The recording and hundreds of others were rescued, in some cases literally pulled out of dumpsters, by Henry Sapoznik, and he is our guide for today's Sound Salon. Henry is a Grammy-winning record and radio producer, director of the Mehrend Institute for Yiddish Culture at the UW-Madison, and he's the pioneering scholar and performer who created the worldwide klezmer music revival. I think he's going to wear all three or four hats today.
I've got a haberdashery for all those hats.
That's good. Because he's here on the radio. We're going to talk about historic recordings. And I see a stringed instrument by your side, Henry. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Anne, for having me here.
What is that instrument?
It is called a tenor guitar. Should I hold it closer to the microphone so people can... No, that won't help. It is a tenor guitar made locally by a great guitar builder named Todd Campio. I'm going to play a little bit later and sort of show the process of how this music happens.
Okay. Well, the Sound Salon is your concept, so I think you should explain it. I personally kind of think of it as a jam session with the past.
That's a really terrific, and if you don't mind, that I will now say that I thought of that. That would mean a lot to me.
You might have.
Yeah. Well, the Sound Salon, when I first came here to UW-Madison, I was just totally blown away by the music resources at the Mills Library. It's just one of the great holdings in the country. And I just thought, wouldn't it be great to introduce people to the historic recordings that are part of American sonic history and also give people a kind of an entree to why these recordings are so important to us and also why are they still meaningful? So the idea to me is both to play the old records, get people really reintroduced to the beauty of sonic hiss and snap, crackle, and pop, but also to show that these recordings are a bridge to a deeper understanding of us as a dynamic people. So old records, new music based on the old records, semi-snide comments about the background of the music. What's not to like?
Oh, and a live audience.
Wow. Yeah. And by the way, I really love what you've done with the place. This is like, I'm just totally at home.
Okay, sorry. Listeners can't see that there are boxes and
come on.
In the corners.
This is radio. No, there's cathedral ceilings and bas-relief paintings.
It's Vilas Hall's Philo Buck Studio, and we are very proud of it and very happy to
be
able to welcome an audience here. So thanks. You said old recordings. How old?
Well, what's really wonderful about these recordings, we're really talking about a bridge to the 19th century, and the beginning of commercial recording happened in around the 1890s. And what's terrific from our point of view when we do Yiddish music is that this is also the beginning of the freestanding Yiddish popular culture, Yiddish theater, popular klezmer music, performers, and so forth. So we get two things happening simultaneously. We get to hear the maturation of sound recording from its earliest days, but we can also follow month by month, year by year, how Yiddish culture changed. Commercial recordings are great that way because they were designed to be sold. So if there are more copies of them out there, it means that these records were more meaningful to the targeted audience.
But so these records are, they're like, I've heard you call them historical or musical Rosetta Stones. I mean, these are, they're more than just, oh yeah, these are nice old recordings. They're really important kind of artifacts, and you found them. They were nearly lost, right?
Well, I got into the Yiddish stuff. My interest in Jurassic technology and with sound recordings really started with Yiddish stuff, hillbilly music. I really love. And what's great about a lot of these recordings, especially the earliest ones, is that they were made by people who they themselves had not grown up with recording. There was such a massive kind of a sonic and a mind shift for people who played music live. And here they had to come into a situation to put it in a 3-minute condensed version.
Why 3 minutes? We're talking about old 78s,
right? It was the technical
right?
limitations of 10-inch recordings, first wax cylinders and then 78s. And I just love this stuff because this was we bandy about the concept of multiculturalism now, but true multiculturalism was being practiced by these early record companies, Columbia, Victor, Edison, where they saw all of these people in the country. They saw the immigrants coming off the boats at Ellis Island. They saw hillbillies and black musicians down south. And he said, not only is this is a potential audience, let's record all this stuff and then sell it back to them. This is like, you know, this is capitalism with a good backbeat. Yeah. So it's really a fascinating moment because all of these 78s, all of these recordings, the tens and tens of thousands of them are kind of audio jigsaw puzzle parts. And what I like about the Sound Salon that we've been able to do is each one has been different. The first one that we did was with my friend and the Dean of American Country Music Historians, Bill Malone. And we did a thing on hillbilly music. And we've done one on Hawaiian music. We've had Yiddish ones. It really shows that we are an incredibly rich country in terms of this music, that maybe these communities for whom this music was originally recorded have lost touch with it. But these records literally stand as a record for this music and still speak to us after all these decades.
Well, let's hear something.
Well, let's start. What's great about the Yiddish recordings and the Mayrent collection here, and by the way, can I make a context? Part of what's great about the Mayrent collection here is that we're able to do a lot of programming around it, and maybe we'll talk about it later.
Well, yeah, you're mentioning Klezkamp is coming up, or Abyssala Klezkamp.
Always
we'll get to it.
Coming
but I
up.
Want to hear one of these records because you gave us a great
lead-in. Some scratchy old records now because you need to hear this. I think we all do. We're going to listen to one of the really interesting things about commercial recording is that it allows us a gateway not just to the era that it was recorded in, but to an earlier era. And I would say of the 10,000 Jewish records recorded in the United States between 1895 and 1955, when the shift happened to LPs, I'd say like 40% were of cantorial music, of liturgical song, which was the sort of the DNA of Jewish music. And we're going to listen first to a piece. This is a piece called Habein Yakirli, which means my dear son. And it's a cantorial piece. And what's really terrific about this, you're going to have to get used to my saying, what's really terrific about this, because I say it about every record, because every record has
They're all terrific. A
scintilla of terrific. This recording was made by a cantor named Alter Yechiel Karniel, and he made this in 1913 when he was 58. Now, what's cool is that the style in which he is singing had peaked in popularity in the 1840s.
Wow.
So in essence, we are not listening to a recording from 1913. We are listening to a message from the middle of the 19th century, and he is our entree. So this is a piece that lets us go back in history an additional half century because he was recorded near the end of his life, and this also, let's hear it, and then I'll tell you what we heard.
Good. Let's hear it.
Let's. I like it.
Just beautiful. What an extraordinary voice. And you're right, it takes you right there. It's like we've gone somewhere.
It's really kind of amazing because people say, well, was this recorded in a synagogue? No, this was recorded in a studio, kind of decontextualized. However, there is this powerful vibe that brings us to the moment of the performance. This sounds like a field recording because this is the way it would have sounded if you were in the synagogue when Carniel recorded this.
Now, tell us something about the cantorial tradition. Cantors are considered the messenger of the people, right?
That is correct. And cantors were the whole sort of mixing of the passion of the liturgical text with a kind of a really vocal and artistic singing style. We're incredibly lucky. Why were 40% of the Jewish records in the 20th century cantorial records? It wasn't like everyone is really religious and they say, oh, I'm going to take this record home so I don't have to go to the synagogue, so I could just listen to the record at home. There was an overlap, an incredible coincidence, that there was this terrific overlap at that period between the recording of cantorial music and a very popular passion for great artistic singing. Caruso, Galicurci, Chaliapin, all of the great art singers. And cantors were part of this audio movement of people who loved great singing.
Almost like the opera stars of the Jewish community.
Well, they were. In fact, there was a great quote of Caruso when he first heard a recording by cantor Gershon Sirota, who was like one of the great cantors. And Caruso was supposed to have said, thank God this man has chosen to ply his trade in the synagogue and not on the opera stage, because Caruso knew he'd be saying, do you want fries with that, if Sirota were singing in the opera.
So, well, the other thing about this tradition is it was all sort of handed down, right? This was a vocal tradition that was passed down from one generation to the next. And then, what happened to that tradition after the Holocaust?
Well, one of the interesting things about commercial recording and about recording in general is it does two things simultaneously. And this is the thing that we will discover as we go through all of the early 78s. On the one hand, it codifies and it preserves that style of music forever on the record. On the other hand, what it does is it sets up a hierarchy. It sets up a valuation. Oh, this is on a record. It must be good. So all of the other styles that maybe didn't get recorded fall away because of the massive influence and popularity of these records. These records remain, and this is one of the great things about the Mayrent Institute and the work that I've been doing for the last 30-odd years, and they have been, seriously, 30-odd years. it has been wild tapping into these old records. This is our ability to be in contact with our teachers, separated by time and space. These records are our guide to a reanimation of this music. So they retain their power for an audience that even the performers and the record companies had absolutely no idea would ever exist. No one thought, oh, we're going to be listening to this when men are on the moon. So it's been great to find how powerful these recordings still are for new audiences.
We're going to take a short break and be right back. Henry Sapoznik is an award-winning author, radio and record producer, and performer of traditional Yiddish and American music. He's a four-time Grammy Award nominee. He's won two Peabody Awards for his work on the Yiddish Radio Project, which aired on NPR, and he is credited with creating the worldwide klezmer revival. I'm Anne Strange-Shampson. This is 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with five-time Grammy-nominated producer and performer Henry Sapoznik, and we just heard a little burst of a clarinet, but maybe that was heralding your appearance.
It's a sound. I'm going to reissue it.
This is our very first Sound Salon, and Henry is the guy credited with launching and creating the worldwide klezmer music revival, and we're here talking about historic sound, historic Yiddish-American recordings, and Henry, I know, is going to perform at some point a little bit also. But Henry, I wanted to go back to talking about cantorial music, because I know that this is a tradition that's very close to you. Your father was a cantor, wasn't he?
My late father, yes, was a cantor.
Did he want you to become one?
He said if I had a voice, I would have been fine. My father had very high standards. I sang with him in a choir until I was 13 when my voice changed. And that's how he learned. He couldn't read what he called dots. And he learned, as we're talking about, handed down generation to generation. And that's how I learned. I sang in choirs. I had a Dickensian Yiddish upbringing, where I was an indentured chorister. I had to sing in choirs to accompany my father for many years.
And how did he learn?
He learned because, as a child, he was abducted because cantors used to abduct children to sing in their choirs. And it's really true. And the city he lived in had a great cantorial tradition. And he, as a child, he was taken into a choir and taught. It was a skill set, like being, if you couldn't sing, you became a shoemaker or a tailor. And he could sing, so he sang with some of the great cantors.
And this was Poland?
This was in Poland, before World War II. And then after he came to the United States, he still was singing. But by then, the taste in this music had changed in the American Jewish community. This was very old style. Had my father lived in an earlier generation, he probably would have been a star. As it is, he worked in a sweatshop.
How did he make it through the Holocaust?
He had been in the Polish army when it fell. Poland was divided. Eastern part was under the Soviets. The western part were under the Germans. He was then inducted into the Red Army, and then was when they heard him sing, he became a member of the Red Army Chorus. But it didn't keep him from being at Stalingrad. So he sang in the chorus, sang great stuff, fought with the Red Army, didn't fight with them. He got along with them. And they came here after the war.
But I was thinking then that for you, as the son of this, literally the child of this tradition, it must feel especially important, personally. Important to be recovering these old records, making sure that we listen to them and keep them alive.
I like that. One of the weird things was when after my father died and I was going through his stuff and I found a tin can with records that he had made after the war in a displaced persons camp in Linz, Austria. Someone had put up the money for him to record some music, and he didn't ever told me about it. I mean, so I found these old records, and I had them transferred. But it was like a scene from Indiana Jones. That while the record is being transferred, it is being destroyed. You only had one chance because it was made on an aluminum disc with a very thin coating of enamel. And as the needle was going through the disc, it was ripping up the surface. I had like one chance to save these records. And it was harrowing. It was really. So I managed to transfer them all. And I did reissue one of them as a sort of, I put him in an anthology with the other great cantors.
Wow. That's an amazing story.
That was cool.
So the cantorial tradition is only one part of the records we were going to talk about. And I wanted to talk about it because we're going to work our way around to klezmer music, but the cantorial tradition, cantorial music, is a piece of the klezmer tradition in some ways, isn't it?
Well, I think if we look at the music culture of the Jews in Eastern Europe and we think of it as a concentric circle, then the center of the concentric circle is cantorial music. The modes, the scales, the vocalizations, the articulations. The best traditional music is always thought to attempt to emulate the human voice. So in this case, cantorial music gave musicians a modal and a scalar kind of a platform from which to perform. So there was a lot of overlap between the liturgical music and a secular music that was derived from it, which on the one hand was klezmer music, on later was Yiddish theater and pop music.
So let's hear another recording. Let's hear something that comes out of,
yes.
I mean, we're moving to this country now. And
yes.
So let's hear something new.
This is really cool. This is a piece by a group called Art Schreier's Modern Yiddish Orchestra. That was a good sales pitch. Art Schreier was a clarinetist. And this is a terrific piece. It's kind of a vaudeville piece where it attempts to recreate a pilgrimage made by the ultra-Orthodox Hasidim to their rabbi. And so it starts off with a little playlet where they're saying, oh, you know, we're going to go visit the rabbi. And then Art Schreier's orchestra, which is really cool. It really shows the influence of the old style Yiddish music, where it's driven by clarinet and fiddle, as with the old bands. But tucked away in the middle is the real influence of American music. There's a tuba, there's a twin tenor banjos, God help us, and a concert harp and slide trombones. This is like the jazz age. And this is a really great record because it's a mashup of old and new for an audience that was also dealing with being new in this country.
Okay, let's take a listen. Love that hiss.
Love that. Twin tenor banjos, the rest of the orchestra is desperately trying to get away from them. But the rhythm just holds on to them.
Why is it that as soon as you hear this, you know that you're listening to Yiddish or Jewish music?
Mm.
But is it the, what is it?
I think it's a lot of the way the sound is created. A lot of times, and again, I come back, you know, I'm a recovering ethnomusicologist. And to me, when I listen to traditional music, when I hear a really good fiddle player or I hear a really great clarinetist, they're talking to me. Their lead musicians are saying something, and they're not just saying it in a staid way. They're trying to have a dialogue with the people for whom they perform. And klezmer music, because it's a grassroots music, because like any great traditional music, it really has a lot based on the cadences of the language.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is whether, because a lot of the people who played in this orchestra would have spoken Yiddish.
That's right.
And I wondered if there's kind of, yes, a rhythm, a pace to the language itself that you then hear in the music.
I think that's what the is great. This is, we have a 3-minute entree into these records. Too bad they don't have like subtitles where, you know, be able to play the record and hear what these guys are thinking. But this is made, that's what's so wonderful about these records, is that these were made by members of the community for members of the community. So there is this intractable sort of really strong link. It wouldn't have worked as well if it had been played by the New York Philharmonic. And people say, well, that's nice, but that's not Jewish.
Did you bring anything that's just spoken word?
I have no secrets from you, obviously. I brought something which is a really wild, unusual. This is probably one of the rarest of all of the rare records, and a lot of these records are pretty rare. I have a recording. It's very short, but this is a recording of the great Yiddish author Shalom Aleichem, who was referred to as the Jewish Mark Twain.
Oh, I've heard that Mark Twain heard that, and he said, tell him I'm the American Shalom Aleichem.
He had a great sense of humor about this. So what this is really This is an unusual moment, and I'll give you the Cliff Notes version of the story. Shalom Aleichem had come to the United States near the end of his life to attempt to sort of coalesce. He was so popular. He was so massively popular that he came to the United States in an attempt to sort of bring together all that he had done. And he got it into his head that he has to make a commercial record. So he goes up to the Victor Studios in Manhattan. And he says, I would like to make a record. And they don't know who Shalom Aleichem is, you know. So they say, come in, Mr. Aleichem, you know, sit down. And he starts reading one of his stories. And his stories, for those who know, I mean, they go on for pages and pages. You know, you'd need a 78 that was like 7 yards in diameter.
Weren't his stories, aren't they the ones the Fiddler on the Roof was based on?
That is, in fact, what it was. Yeah. It was based on his Tevye stories. So he sits down and he starts reading one of these stories. And at about a minute and a half, he stops. And then way in the background, you hear the engineer say, is that all you got? Part two.
Okay, let's hear that.
When ich bin Rothschild, am Anolot, in Shalom Aleichem. Wenn ich bin Rothschild, ay, wenn ich so sein Rothschild, erstens, wollte ich die Jiden, mein Jidene, adreieren, als ein Kind für den Schabbat, so sie hoben bei sich in Keschenja adreieren, es soll mir den Ding ins Vorbeck. Und zweitens, wenn ich gerade gestiebt, wollte ich ja weggekippt, den ganzen mit der Kammer, mit dem Keller, mit dem Stauern, mit dem Stellachle, mit dem Spiegern, mit dem Schachtelbacken, mit dem Fleck. Sich wollte ich übergelassen, nur ein Cheder auf die Knell, und die Siebereke wollte ich ja weggegeben hier, mit der Kirche, Nadier, Backier, Kochier, Brutier, Brennier, von all der schwarze Jürgen.
You can almost hear it in the background. He says, is that all you got? They thanked him. They escorted him out. And they put the record on the shelf. And it sat until the next year when Shalom Aleichem died. And they read in the paper that 500,000 people turned out for his funeral. Wow. So someone at the Victor Studio says, wait a second. Wasn't that guy in here last year? They quickly rushed out this record. They rushed it out so quickly, it didn't even have a catalog number. They rushed it out to capitalize while his body was still warm. It hardly sold, and making it really one of the rarest records. And this was a piece, if I were Rothschild, I would, you know, this is where If I Were a Rich Man was derived from this monologue.
If I Were a Rich Man. But
it sounds better when he does it.
How did you find the Shalom Aleichem recording?
When I worked, the great thing about collecting 78s is that every time a box of 78s shows up, it is a combination of your birthday and Hanukkah, Christmas, and Ed McMahon showing up for the great contest that you've just won. So every record is a new surprise. So when I was working at the YIVO Institute in New York, I found this record, and it had come with a bunch of other records that were not as illustrious. But when I saw it, I was like completely amazed because there was no indication that this record had ever been made because it did not have a catalog number. It did not appear in the catalogs of the time.
So, and this is the only recording of him?
Well, there was a recording that he made in 1912, the opening of the Jewish Ethnographic Museum in St. Petersburg, and he made a wax cylinder for them, but it wasn't as cool as this.
So it's kind of like discovering William Shakespeare made a recording.
Absolutely, or Mark Twain, who was the Gentile Shalom Aleichem.
There's one more historical piece I know you brought. Can we hear one more?
Yes. This is a cool piece. Right? Did I warn you that I was going to say this is going to be another cool piece?
You said terrific.
Yes. I was
You're
right.
Varying your adjectives. That's
I am.
Good.
This is radio. It's a yawning maw. You know, I have to keep coming up with new stuff. This is a record that was it's a song written for Yiddish vaudeville in the 1920s. And it's a terrific piece. But what I like about it is that this will work. I think, can we do this?
Yes. You and I talked about this.
Here's
what we wanted to do. So the point, I know, for you is not simply to be a curator of wonderful old historical music, but to really create, have a dialogue with it, right? So you're a performer, and I wanted to really hear, literally, how you go from the old to the new. So you said you could make that happen.
Well, I think that what's going to happen. What I do is I like a lot of these screwy old vaudeville, these weird records. So I write these singable English translations based on the kind of the color and the nuance. And this then gives the contemporary audience a kind of a gateway. So here's a piece called I Am a Boarder at My Wife's. And I wrote this translation because I had met this guy, Fivish Finkel, who was the singer on here, was a folks might remember him. He got an Emmy for a show called Picket Fences. Hmm. So he was this really great old Yiddish performer, and he made this record in 1942. Lord knows, he had forgotten that he had made this record. So I found it, and I said, Fivish, look what I have. And it was like finding, he says, I've been looking for that sock since, 1948. It's like this thing that he once had and he once really loved. So I made this, I wrote this translation of this song, and I gave it to him, and I said, bring it to the next generation. So what I thought maybe we would do is maybe we would listen to the beginning of this original recording, and then I would impose myself into the performance and kind of fill out what the audience then would have appreciated about this. They wanted it in Yiddish, and I wrote a little English translation.
Okay, let's hear it. So we'll start with the recording.
Gedenkt hab ich dem Muffen, herum gesicht zum Schluppen, hat mein Wabel mich übergerät. Muss auf die Sichen glicken, in Fremden um sich stecken, in sein Alleine retten sie die Band. Bleib du immer pink wie früher, sei ein Borde jetzt bei mir, wie ein Fremde zu lich in dem Renn. Oh, ich bin ein Borde bei meinem Wab. Männer, ist du sat heire Job. Sie attendet mich mit alles, wenn ich gefragt, sie kisch alles. Ich bin a Borde bei meinem Wab.
My wife and I just parted, and I'm back where I started, like a bachelor when I was a kid. I gave some thought to moving, but my wife said disapproving, stay right here, it's better, so I did. Why go and look for shelter, half-cocked and helter-skelter, just to be alone and save a cent? A favor, stay right here, it'll work out, have no fear, like a stranger I pay her my rent, 'cause I am a boarder at my wife's. What an improvement in our lives, no more problems, never harried, we are happily unmarried. I am a boarder at my wife. I tell you folks I'm lucky, everything's just ducky, it's better to be renting than be wed. I don't have to worry, 'cause she won't make me hurry, if I choose to stay out late instead. My wife used to berate me, belittle and deflate me, in short she made my life a living hell. But since I've started paying rent, I've been treated like a gent. The best revenge I found is living well, 'cause I am a boarder at my wife's. What an improvement in our lives. No more problems, never harried. We are happily unmarried. I am a boarder at my wife's. Weil ich bin a boarder bei mein Weib. Teire Job. Sie attendet mich mit alles, wenn ich kein Freund, sie kein Scheiles. Ich bin der Boden bei meinem Hab.
Woo. Oh, oh, that's so much fun.
It is.
And you know, he sings, but the character of the wife looms so large.
Oh, my God. The flip side is her saying, get out. No, actually, it's not true. But it's really cool because it's like, it's pop music, and it really kind of shows how the influence on this culture was vast.
We're talking with Henry Sapoznik. When we come back from a short break, more playing and more talking. You are listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with award-winning author, radio, and record producer and performer of traditional Yiddish and American music, Henry Sapoznik. And Henry, thanks so much for being here. That was a great performance. And I want to open this up. We've got a studio audience here and see if anybody has any questions.
What a nice bunch.
Anybody have any questions to ask? Yes. Got a microphone over
there. We got a microphone over there.
I'm Angela Bartel from Madison, and recently, luckily, returned from a trip to Spain in Granada. There is a gypsy community that sings the original flamenco.
Yeah, sure. The
cantaores. It used to be a large Jewish community there. And my goodness, they are living and singing much of the same idioms mixed with other things, Indian, etc. But the music is alive.
Yeah, and the Jewish community in what was the Jewish community in Spain, the Sephardic Jews, had a parallel kind of experience because here in Yiddish, which has certain characteristics it shares with German and mixed with Slavic and Hebrew, well, the same thing as it was with the Sephardic Jews, the Ladino Jews, who were expelled in 1492, the same year that Columbus sailed. So there are these strong kind of parallels, but they're parallels because these two communities were physically and geographically in other areas, but retained their regional traditions for generations.
You've gone back to the roots of
American. The roots.
Under the roots.
I am in the
Paleolithic. But those roots are underpinning that line of music. I was so surprised to hear it there and then to hear it in the old record, the record that you started with, the cantorial tradition. To hear the echo of it is just amazing.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
Well, I think partly you're talking about what it means to for a tradition to be a living tradition. Because, again, going back to what you've done in terms of sparking a revival of klezmer music, I mean, you could have just said, oh, wow, look at these wonderful things. I'm going to issue a few box sets and be done with it. But you wanted to bring it into the present and keep it going, keep playing with it. And what's the difference between kind of musical, simply reproducing the past in music and keeping it a living tradition?
I think that, and that's a really good question about the concept of a living tradition, because it seems to be sort of antithetical. But what's really great, you know, most music traditions that are out there, most cultures that have music traditions, whether it's Latino music or whether it's Greek or Polish, you can get on an airplane and you can go to the old country and you're going to eventually find some old guy who's on his porch and scraping away at a fiddle. The one community that you cannot do this with is the Jewish community because of the massive discontinuity of the Holocaust and assimilation and of Sovietization. So these records, the klezmer music world and the Yiddish music world is probably unique in that it was driven almost primarily by access to these 78 records as opposed to intergenerational transmission. There has been intergenerational transmission, but not to the extent of other communities that were socially intact. So these records become even more vital as a way of reanimating cultural literacy.
So could you play something that maybe is an example of how you've taken from the past and brought it into the present?
Yeah, maybe let me do, I think, you know, for a long time, the core of the music in the community was a cappella. And as we heard on the cantorial record, that's a cappella. That's traditional stuff. You have the cantor, you have the choir. I want to do a song that I grew up hearing. Then this is a song about the Hasidim, about the ultra-Orthodox Jews on a pilgrimage to visit their holy man, to visit their Rebbe. And his song talks about the town that the rabbi lives in. The town is called Kotsk in Poland. And the verse, I'll sing a couple of verses because it does, this is supposed to be sung during the pilgrimage. And they basically say, to Kotsk, you have to go, But you can't ride there. You have to go on foot. If you're making a pilgrimage, you must go on foot. And interestingly, in a kind of a Talmudic way, they translate the various meanings of the word regel, which is Hebrew for foot. And here they say foot indicates joy because you use the foot to make the pilgrimage, but you also use it for dancing. And so they say you are to go on this pilgrimage with joy and dancing. And it goes into these other kind of translations. But I thought I would just sing a little bit of this song. And unknown when it was written, probably the end of the 19th century. But it's called Kotsk. Ka Kotsk fut minit. Ka Kotsk gate men. Weil Kotsk jedoch bim koim hamigdosh. Weil Kotsk jedoch bim koim hamigdosh. Kakotsk mis min oile regel sein. Regel das meint, me geit ze fies. Me darf no gein zu kurz ze fies. Singen dick und tanzen dick. Unas xidim gein Kakotsk. Geht men mit Gesang. Und als Chsidim gehen Kakotsk, geht men mit Gesang. Kakotsk fühlt men nicht. Kakotz geht men, weil Kotzk jedoch bim koim hamigdosh, weil Kotzk jedoch bim koim hamigdosh. Kakotzk mis min oile regel sein. Regels gedoch is a teitscha gewähnschaft. Men darf sein, sie gewähnt, zu sehen Kakotsk. Singen dick und tanzen dick. Unas chsidin gehen Kakotsk. Geht men mit a Tanz. Unas chsidim gehen Kakotsk. Geht men mit a Tanz.
Bennett, did you write that, or is that an older one?
Did I write this? Wow, what a compliment. No, this is a song written in folk style. Hasidim did not do this kind of thing, but this is written about them that attempts to transmit for another part of the Jewish community the passion that this community had. So this is a song about them, and no.
Mm. Okay.
I did not.
We have another question from the audience. Hey.
Hi, Hank. Jim Leary from UW-Madison here. Regarding your role in the Klezmer Revival, I wonder if you might be willing to tell about that pivotal experience you had with the North Carolina old-time fiddler, Tommy Jarrell.
Now, this is the creation myth of the Klezmer Revival.
Who are you people? Who sent you here? Okay. All right. Well, this actually, as someone who grew up as a child of Holocaust survivors, I wanted nothing more than to be more American than everyone else. And I felt the only way to really be really American, I made the transition from Pete Seeger to Mike Seeger. That was one of my two rabbis. I went from, and one of those things, I was incredibly lucky to have been invited to go down to Mount Airy, North Carolina, the real-life home of Mayberry, where Andy Griffith was from, and to study with a fiddle player and banjo player named Tommy Jarrell. And Tommy was the mecca of old-time music. They called him Swami Tommy or St. Tommy of Mount Airy. And people would come study with him. And it was just amazing. It was like this you've stepped into a time machine, because Tommy played old-time fiddle and banjo and stuff. But he was confused. Tommy was confused because here were these kids coming from New York who were coming to study with him, and he was puzzled. And I was lucky enough, I got to live with him for a while I was learning to play banjo and fiddle. And one day, in a moment of deep, unsettling candor, he says to me, he was confused that all these Jews were coming. A lot of the people were either Jews or Catholics, and he couldn't tell the difference. Sometimes, some of us can't tell the difference. It's like so he says, Hank, says, don't your people got none of your own music? I mean, he was so puzzled. And I said, well, yes, Tommy, we have our own music. And I'm thinking, well, we got Hava Nagila? This is awful. That is no trade-off for listening to Tommy singing Drunken Hiccups. And it was so, I mean, here I was trying to immerse myself. And he was such a generous host. Southern Hospitality lived there. He was such a generous host that I wanted to be that music. I wanted to. But then he got me thinking, is there a Jewish Tommy Jarrell? Is there a Jewish music like that? And more importantly, if there's a Jewish Tommy Jarrell, does he drink as much as this Tommy Jarrell? So it was a real watershed moment for us both.
So did you find a Jewish Tommy Jarrell?
I found several of them. I was incredibly lucky because I grew up with this stuff. But part of the problem of it being so close to you is that you don't see it. And once I went back to New York and had kind of recalibrated my brain, and I wasn't looking for fiddlers, I eventually found fiddlers, but I wasn't looking for banjo players as such. I had to recalibrate how I thought about this music. And I suddenly realized that I had grown up with these people. My late father, when he was a cantor, we would go to all these hotels in the Catskills, what was called the Borscht Belt. I knew all these musicians who would play dance music at night, but I always referred to them as round men playing square music. and it was very unpleasant for me. I didn't like it because it was redolent of a world that I no longer wanted to be part of. But once I had my brain reinstalled and I rebooted my cultural literacy, I realized that these guys were Tommy, except they were Jewish.
There's this phrase that's just been in my head the whole time we've been talking. There's a Jewish concept, tikkun olam, to repair the world.
Yeah.
It seems to me that's what you're doing.
It's easier to repair the world in a situation like that than it is sometimes to repair a 78. they're pretty fragile. And yet these 78s repair the world. These give voice to a people who are alienated from their culture. And it's not just in the Jewish community. That's why I'm so thrilled to have access to one of the great collections in the country. This could go on indefinitely, all of these great records. And using the records as a gateway, I try to create programming, and the Sound Salon was one, where we introduce the records and we say, yes, come visit the records, come learn from them. And programs like Abyssal Eccles Camp, where we bring all of this culture into a concentrated moment where people can come regardless of their cultural past.
Okay, we segued right to it. We're almost out of time, and I promised you I wanted to make sure we mentioned Abyssal Eccles Camp for people who are interested in anything you've heard. There's a free one-day event.
12 hours of Yiddish madness, unfettered.
When, where?
Sunday, July 21st, here on the UW campus at Union South.
Okay. Sounds great. Henry, it has been so great having you here. And listen, will you play us out?
I sure can. We want we want noodles, or we want...
Yeah.
How much time? Okay, good. Here's just a little bit of an instrumental piece. This is kind of a showpiece for musicians. It's called Doina, and it's a kind of a vocal version of a instrumental.
Wisconsin Public Radio.